Okay, Shuli, welcome. Part 5, Boker Tov, everybody, Erev Tov. We should hear good news from Israel and around the world. And this is the last of our series, of course, on modern Israel. And a pleasure to welcome once again from Alon Shvut, Shuli.
Okay, hi everybody. I was telling Rabbi Kelman before we started, it's a strange feeling to be teaching and to be teaching history in particular and not Torah per se, because you look back and you say, well, where were we then? Where are we now? And I guess what I have to say is, I don't know how much schut there is in my teaching, but I think there is a lot of schut in this large tzibur that's here. And I just ask you all, which I'm sure you all are, to have Israel in your thoughts and in your prayers, and you know, an extra parak of Tehillim for us will not hurt anybody. But let's get started. We're going to go back into the past, and what we're going to do in our final class in this modern Zionism is to talk about two different things. We're going to talk about between 48 and 67, and really with a focus on Jerusalem. We'll talk a little bit about the rest of the country, the borders, but mostly the focus is going to be on Jerusalem, because Jerusalem is a divided city, is really the most dramatic example of what's going on here between 48 and 67 in terms of military and security and everything else. And then the last third or so of the class, we're going to talk about the background to the Six-Day War and what happens in the Six-Day War. Obviously, this is a very large topic, like all of them, and there's much more than what we are going to do today. So the situation in Israel between 48 and 67, in Israel in general and in Jerusalem in particular, is unique and is unusual. I would even say strange. On the one hand, thank God we have the miracle of the victory in the War of Independence, something that is definitely not to be taken for granted. It was not at all clear that Israel would emerge out of the War of Independence. We have the miracle that not only did we emerge out of the War of Independence, but we actually got, and we'll see the maps in a minute, we actually got more than we had been promised in partition, and an additional miracle that we got Jerusalem, not all of Jerusalem, but some of Jerusalem, right? And these are all unbelievable things. The other positive is that the years between 48 and 67, to a large extent, with exceptions here and there, were relatively quiet years. Okay, now that's on the positive side. On the negative side, we are living in a country with very, very narrow borders in certain places, a lot of tension, and there's nowhere where that tension is expressed more clearly than in Jerusalem. Because here you have Jerusalem, on the one hand, this place where all Jewish eyes are turned to for hundreds upon hundreds of years, and yet it's divided. We are cut off from the holy places, and it's a city with an international border down the middle of it, which of course leads to much tension and difficulties. Now, the picture you're looking at here is one of the many amazing pictures that we have from that time period. Some people may recognize what you're looking at. Basically, you're looking at the old city walls from Jaffa Gate, more or less down towards Zion Gate, right? Here's the Dormition Church over here. We are standing in Mamila, right? That's the perspective from which the picture is taken. Mamila, which today is this fabulous, fancy shopping mall connecting the old city and the new city. But then it was really some of it belonged to Israel, but most of it was no man's land. And you can see abandoned, unsanitary, dangerous place in between Israel in the west and Jordan in the east. The other thing to recognize, to realize about Jerusalem, we'll see this when we look at the borders in a minute, is that it's the end of the line, right? It's the end of the road. It's a little nothing backwater. When we think about Jerusalem today, okay, not in the last 14 months or so, but anyone who's been in Jerusalem in the last 20 years, 30 years knows that it's a tourism mecca. You cannot come to Israel without stopping in Jerusalem. Tour buses, people from all over the world stand at Jaffa Gate for a half hour, and you will see people from 20 different countries at least. And there's nothing like that in Jewish Jerusalem between 48 and 67. Okay? And there's very little room to expand. So let's take a look at our borders, at our maps for a moment. Okay? Look at the map on the left. right? A simplified but an important map showing what does Israel look like between 49, right? Ceasefires and 67. On the one hand, like I said before, we are in much better shape than we were with partition. If you recall or have in your head, the partition map, right? The Galilee had been cut in half, half to the Jews, half to the Arabs. No Jerusalem, right? Jerusalem was not any part of the Jewish state here. It's half of the Jewish state. And even in the Negev, right, the Arabs had been given more. So we definitely got more than we would have gotten with partition. Okay? On the other hand, of course, we do not have Judea and Samaria, right, the West Bank that belongs to Jordan. We do not have the area of Gaza. We don't have the area of the Golan, but that wasn't really so much of a on the table. And we don't have half of Jerusalem. Now, the other thing that's important to notice about this map is the narrowness, right? Israel's very narrow waist around Netanya, okay? Borders are difficult in many places, better than they would have been under partition, but still difficult borders. But certainly this narrowness, right? And this is what we talk about when we talk about, you know, possible peace agreements and giving back Judea and Samaria, giving it to the Palestinians. How could we go back to these terrible borders? So that's important to keep in mind, that this is really what Israel lives under for 19 years, this very, very narrow waist, this very narrow border. Now, the other thing to take a look at is Jerusalem, right? And this is where we're talking about this strange situation. Jerusalem is divided, I won't say in half because it isn't really in half. If you look, right, the whole south, right, south of Ramat Rachel is Jordan, okay? East, obviously the old city and everything else is Jordan. And north, right? North, what today is Ramat Eshkol and the new neighborhoods of Jerusalem, this is Jordan as well. So first of all, in terms of Israel being able to expand, the only way Jerusalem can expand in those years is to the west. The west is the only part that is open to Jewish settlement. And that's important. And we're going to see that a lot of new institutions do develop in the west, okay? The other things that are important to notice about this map, obviously the whole old city in Jordanian hands, except for one little piece, and that's Mount Zion. And we're going to talk about Mount Zion, which is a strange place. And you'll also see these strange little yellow bits, right? What are those? So those, as we're going to talk about, are two things, right? Three things, really. You have what's called the DMZ, demilitarized areas, areas that might belong to Israel, might belong to Jordan, might belong to the UN. In any case, soldiers not allowed there, only policemen, okay? You have area that is no man's land, right? And that's what you're seeing over here. No man's land, meaning it's disputed territory. Jordanians refuse to compromise and won't give up on anything. So no man's land essentially remains places that nobody is allowed to go into, and they become health hazards. And then we have what's called the thickness of the line. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, about the strangeness of this border, but we'll hold on to that for a second. And finally, what I want you to notice is Mount Scopus, which is the other weird thing on this map. Mount Scopus, deep in Jordanian territory, remains in Israeli hands. Okay. And that is going to be very important. It's a very strategic position, but it is clearly off limits to civilians, only military, really supposed to be policemen, but it's really soldiers can go up here. Okay, so that's all our scribbling on our map, but important to understand, oh, people who were interested in where is Sheikh Jarrah, right? The neighborhood that's been in the news a lot recently, that was a Jewish neighborhood bought by Jews before 48 and then given over, you know, Jordanians took it over after 48 and today is disputed, right? That's where Sheikh Jarrah is. We are not going to talk about Sheikh Jarrah, but just so you know where it is. Okay. What about this strange border, right? By September 48, the battles are more or less over in Jerusalem. They're going to continue. The War of Independence continues till March 49. But Jerusalem, the battles are more or less over. And at the end of November, November 30th, 1948, right? Literally exactly a year since the conflict began after the UN partition vote, Moshe Dayan, who you can see here on the right, and his Jordanian counterpart, Abdallah Attal, sit down in an abandoned house on the border in Musrara to draw up a map, right? This is what the Israelis hold. This is what the Jordanians hold. Let's sit down and figure it out so that we can have some kind of a ceasefire agreement. Now, they have this map, and the scale is rather large, meaning what does that mean? Right? A line, which is like a millimeter thick in real life, is 60 to 80 meters, okay? Now, they are sitting down with this map. They're sitting down on a rough stone floor, okay, where the pencils skip as they're writing. And they're also using thick wax pencils, green ones and red ones. That's the origin of the term, the green line, by the way. Now, they know they're not fools. They know that when they're drawing their lines, that in real life, it's not a line, it's 60 to 80 meters. That's pretty big. They're not so worried about this because they said this is just the draft, right? Eventually we're going to go, we're going to sit down at a normal table, we'll draw up something real, and this is just to give us an idea of what we have. As somebody should have told them, there's nothing so permanent in the Middle East as something temporary, and that's exactly what happens here. Not only do they never draw up a new map, they don't even make a copy of the first map, okay? This map that they draw on the floor in Musrara goes into the safe in the United Nations headquarters in Armon HaNatziv. It stays there for 19 years. Anytime there's any kind of a conflict, they go back to this map, okay? And that's it. There is nothing else. And that's what causes a lot of the issues, the conflicts in those days, right? Because it's unclear where everything should be. Okay, this is something we mentioned last time. We'll just mention it briefly. Population transfer, okay? Arabs flee the Jewish side. Either they flee the country completely, and that's a lot of the middle to upper class Christian Arabs, by the way, or they go to the old city, other places where Jews were. Jews have to leave the old city and places where, you know, where the Jordanians conquer, and they have to go to the new city. Population switch. At the end of the battles, you have 100,000 Jews in Jerusalem. You have 65,000 Arabs. You have a lot of what is known in Hebrew as rechush natush, which is a very complicated story. It's also part of this Sheikh Jarrah story. Rechush Natush means abandoned property. And essentially what happens is that the Jews who left the old city, which is the picture that you see here on the right, Jews going out of Zion Gate, right, leaving behind their property, and they need a place to go. And where do they go? They move to the neighborhoods in southern Jerusalem that had been Arab neighborhoods that the Arabs picked themselves up and ran away. So for example, Katamon, right? And this is the house that you see here on the left. This is a beautiful Arab house in Katamon. Even today, by the way, if you read the real estate listings for places like Katamon and Baka, a lot of times it will say something like old Arab house, right? That gives it cachet. It's, they're beautifully built houses. Except what happened is that you had, you know, hundreds of families who needed to move into something. So these beautiful houses are parceled up into two-room apartments. When we first came to Israel, we lived in Katamon for a year, and we lived in one of these houses that had been divided up into little bitty apartments, okay? So they moved to places like that, or to Baka, or the picture you have in the middle, Ein Karim, right? Ein Karim, Arab village on the outskirts of Jerusalem, very little in the way of infrastructure, but a kind of an agricultural village, and the Arabs flee, and Jewish immigrants are bussed in and are put in these places, whether or not they want to be there, right? That's a separate question. Refugees, new immigrants, they are housed there. Northern Jerusalem, right? That's a story in and of itself. There are only two Jewish neighborhoods that are built in the north of the city, right? North of the old city, before 48. One is called Atarot, right? It was a second Aliyah neighborhood that was started already before World War I. Eventually, the British come and kind of squeeze out a little bit of the neighborhood and build an airstrip. And some people may remember that after 67, it was an airstrip again until the second Intifada, until the 2000s. It was an airport right outside of Jerusalem. So one neighborhood is Atarot. The other neighborhood is Neve Yaakov, which is founded more than 10 years later by the Mizrahi in the late 1920s. Both of these neighborhoods, Atarot and Neve Yaakov, they're kind of like the countryside of Jerusalem. This is where you had agriculture, fresh milk, people would go out for the fresh air, right? And they were thriving neighborhoods for quite some time. But by the time we get to 1948 and even before, they're very isolated. They're attacked by the Arabs, and ultimately they are abandoned in May 1948. The picture you have here on the left is of the streets of Neve Yaakov, earlier than 48, obviously. The picture here on the right is a memorial to the defenders of Atarot. And these places are resettled after 1967. And Neve Yaakov today is a very large ultra-Orthodox neighborhood. Atarot was an airport, is no longer, but it is now an industrial zone. And so that's just, you know, to know about these neighborhoods along with many others that are built post 67. Okay, this is what we talked about a little bit, this issue of the various places along the border, right? So if you look at this, another picture, another amazing picture from Mamila on the left here, right? You can understand this concept of no man's land, right? Nobody can go in to clean, to take out the garbage. It's unhygienic. It's dangerous, right? Plus you have all the other things of borders, right? Walls, mines, barbed wire, etc., right? In the center of the city, it's hard to imagine for people who only know modern Jerusalem, only know Jerusalem of the last 10 years, that this is what Jerusalem looked like in the middle, right? In the old city. You also had, of course, signs everywhere, danger, no passage, enemy in front of you. You had Jordanian and Israeli outposts all along the line, right? All along the border. And of course, you have these issues of the thickness of the line that we're going to talk about in a few minutes. The United Nations comes in, the British leave, and the United Nations comes in because, you know, ostensibly here is the city with an international border, and we need to have somebody who's going to make sure that things are nice and quiet and peaceful, and the UN is meant to mediate between the two sides. I don't know how much they do that. That's an interesting question. But what they do is they take over the very fabulous building that the British built when they come in, right? The British come in to the land of Israel. They take over from the Ottoman Turks after World War I. They want their headquarters to be in Jerusalem, right? Ironically, the Jews had their headquarters in Jaffa, Tel Aviv. And it's only when the British say, well, you know, it's Jerusalem, it's kind of an important place, that the Jews actually move their government headquarters to Jerusalem. But the British come in, they need a place to be. They start out on the Mount of Olives in Augusta, Victoria. It's not ideal. And so they commission an architect, the same architect who designed the Rockefeller Museum, Austin St. Barbie Harrison, to build them a very impressive, imposing building on the top of a hill in the south of Jerusalem. Today, it's at the edge of the Tayelet, of the promenade. It's still a beautiful building. It still can be seen from all over. That was part of the idea, right? That everybody knows the British presence is here. But when the British leave in 48, it passes into the hands of the UN, who still are there today. It's not a particularly friendly place. And the Six-Day War, when it breaks out in Jerusalem, actually breaks out here. The Jordanian soldiers advance from their post just meters away, go to the UN headquarters, basically say to them, we're taking this over now. And the UN kind of skedaddles and allows the Jordanians to take over. So how much they're actually helping in the conflict, not so helpful. Life on the border is complicated. Okay, for Jews with no access to the holy places, right, besides all the tensions that we'll talk about in a minute, but with no access to the holy places, they want to be able to at least look into the old city. And there are a few places where you can do that. Okay? One is this picture on the right here, and some of this building is still around. This is at the edge of a neighborhood called Abu Tor in South Jerusalem. Abu Tor, more or less next door to Yamin Moshe, Mishkenot Sha'ananim. Abu Tor is a fascinating neighborhood. Today, it's still a divided neighborhood, meaning Jewish and Arab. There are Jews who live in one part of the neighborhood. There are Arabs who live in another. But between 48 and 67, the border actually ran down a street in Abu Tor, literally down the middle of the street. Jews on one side, Jordanians on the other side. And at the edge of the neighborhood, there was a point where you have an amazing view of the old city. And tour buses would actually come to this place. The tour guide would make sure to tell the visitors before they got off the bus, do not point when you are looking at all the landmarks, because the Jordanian soldiers who were very close by and were watching every move would interpret that as a rude gesture and use it as an excuse to open fire. So no pointing. Hey, okay? But the Abu Tor lookout was one of the places one of the few places where you could actually look into the Old City from the Israeli side of Jerusalem. Right? Another place is this picture here on the left, which has a story in and of itself. I'll tell you in a moment. But this is Notre Dame. Okay? This is a French Catholic institution with a hospital, with a convent for nuns. It's across the street from the Old City, across the street from Newgate, from the entrance into the Christian Quarter. It was built at the end of the 19th century. And the roof, it's another place where you could look into the Old City. And I've had people tell me that when they came here as teenagers, right, on Israel trips, they were taken to the roof to look into the Old City. It was also an Israeli army outpost. Now, you can see from this early picture, this is a picture from the 50s, I don't know exactly what year, you can see the massive hole blasted in the building. And that's part of the story here as well, right? At the end of May, towards the end of May, the Arabs are advancing towards Jewish Jerusalem. It's not at all clear how the chips are going to fall. Is the Old City going to remain in Jewish hands? Is Jerusalem itself going to remain in Jewish hands? And meanwhile, the Jordanians are at Damascus Gate, right, slightly to the north and the east of Notre Dame, and they are advancing with tanks towards Jewish Jerusalem. It's literally a 5-minute walk, and the Jews don't know what to do. Tanks come to Jaffa Road. That's it. That's the end of Jewish Jerusalem, and they have to stop the tanks. There's really very few ways to stop a tank. One of them is to explode a building. Right? Because if the building falls into the street, the tanks can't pass. And that's exactly what they do. They lay heavy, heavy explosives on one of the wings of Notre Dame. They blow it open 22nd of May. It blocks the road. It saves Jewish Jerusalem. You can imagine that the nuns of Notre Dame were not exactly thrilled by this, but it was a necessary action to save the city. Now, this situation of this border down the middle of the city often created absurd situations. It created dangerous situations, but they were relatively rare. We have Ramat Rachel, right, the archaeological site, the kibbutz at the south of Jerusalem. There was an archaeological conference there in 1954. The Jordanians opened fire and killed 4 archaeologists. You had incidents like that, but more often than not, it was just tense with some very absurd situations. Some of one of the most famous situations is this great picture here on the left. This is also taking place in Notre Dame. Basically, what happened is there's a hospital there, and one morning, one of the patients wanted some air. She opened her window, and her window looked down on no man's land, and then she was overcome by a coughing fit. She coughed so hard that she coughed her false teeth out of her mouth, and they fell down into no man's land. That's a bit of a problem. It's not just that they have to be found, but you cannot go look for them until you talk to the Israelis, the Jordanians, and the United Nations. And once this international coalition was gathered, this nice nun could go down and look for the teeth. And this is where she is standing. She finally triumphantly found the teeth, and she's holding them up. She's very pleased next to these enormous soldiers. This was such a great story that Life magazine sent a photographer, and that's why we have great pictures from it. Hey, you had other ridiculous stories, kids playing ball on the border, in the neighborhoods on the border, like Mishkenot Sha'ananim, would kick them into no man's land. Every Christmas, the Jordanian soldiers would collect the balls that had accumulated in the Hinnom Valley and give them back to the kids on both sides, right? Crazy situations. You also had some camaraderie, right? Israeli soldiers, Jordanian soldiers, literally across the street from each other. You have a great picture of them, sharing cigarettes or a cup of coffee. I can't see what's going on in that picture exactly, right? We also know that they exchanged newspapers because each side was curious to see how the other side was portrayed. So you just had this very odd and unusual situation, but one that continued. Now, the maps that I found here, this is from the National Library website. I just love them because they show you how both sides essentially ignore the other, right? Take a look at this Jordanian map. Right, the Jordanian map, which, by the way, shows you the road to Ramallah over here, Derech Shechem, going out to the north. Obviously, lots of detail on the Jordanian side, especially in the Old City, right, all over. But Mount Scopus, demilitarized area. We don't need to know any more about that. And even more so, right, what happens after the border? Occupied territory of Jerusalem. No more details. It doesn't even appear in the map. Okay, look at the Israeli counterpart, right? Same thing. Okay, we have, at least we put in the Old City because the Old City is important. But in general, general, it's the Israeli side, and we're not particularly interested in what's on the other side, right? And we don't know very much about what's on the other side. The not knowing, by the way, is going to be important, because in the Six-Day War, the soldiers really don't know where they are when they go into enemy territory. Now, the story of Hadassah, right? Remember the story of Mount Scopus, right? Mount Scopus is this place that in the 20s, in the 10s, 20s, 30s, was one of the most hopeful places in Jerusalem for Zionists. Zionists felt that Mount Scopus was going to be the new center, the new temple in many ways, right? Hebrew University, this new intellectual center with Jewish scholars from all over the world. And then later, Hadassah Hospital is built here, a new modern hospital. And this feeling that Mount Scopus is almost to a certain extent taking over, right? More secular Jews feeling like this, but taking over or being a counterpart to the Temple Mount. All of those hopes come crashing down when Mount Scopus is essentially within Jordanian territory, right? It starts even before the complete conquest. April 1948, we have the terrible attack of what's called Shayeret Ha'ayin Chet, the convoy of the 78, a convoy of doctors and nurses and patients going up to Hadassah on Mount Scopus, attacked on the way in Sheikh Jarrah, and 78 doctors, nurses, and patients are massacred. Terrible, terrible story. The British do nothing to stop it for hours and hours. And it becomes very clear that even if we hold on to Mount Scopus, this cannot be a place that civilians can come to. This can't be a university. This can't be a hospital anymore. So you need to find alternate sites, right? These are institutions that have been around already for a couple of decades. Where are you going to put them? So for the first few years, they are housed in temporary places in all different parts of the city. If you walk around central Jerusalem, downtown Jerusalem, and you pay attention, you'll see plaques in various places saying, here was the Hebrew University biology department in the early 50s, right? Here was the Hebrew University chemistry department. Okay, two places where they were. One is the Terra Sancta building, which is at the corner of where King George becomes Keren HaYesod, the King's Hotel is on the other side. Okay, this is a Franciscan, a Catholic institution that was part of it was taken over in the early years after 48 to be used by Hebrew University. Another is the one of the famous buildings in Mamila that was taken apart and put back together, right? And you can see the numbers showing how to put it back together. And there were buildings in Mamila on the Jewish side, on the Israeli side, that were also used by Hebrew University, but this was not enough. And both institutions needed to find new campuses. Hebrew University moves to Givat Ram. We'll tell the story of that place in a little bit. In the mid to late 50s, they build a new campus in the western part of the city. And Hadassah does something very unusual. They move so far out that even today, the Hadassah branch in the west, Hadassah Ein Karim, even today feels isolated, even though Jerusalem has been expanded so much. Certainly in the 50s, it's completed in 1961, this was the ends of the earth, right? This was above the village of Ein Karim, but there really was nothing else. Why did they pick such an isolated spot? It was actually a very smart idea because it meant that there was room to expand. So, you know, when Michael Bloomberg wants to spend another $1 trillion to build another building in honor of his mother, there's plenty of room for it. So we're very happy, right? After the Six-Day War, both of the campuses went back into use. And today the hospital and the university are both big enough that they need two campuses. But obviously before 67, only the Western campuses were being used. Now there's only one crossing point in Jerusalem, and it's not even really a crossing point because while people can come from Jordan and cross into Israel, you could not come, except for a few exceptions that we'll talk about, you could not come from Israel and cross into Jordan, right? And certainly if you were Israeli, you could not cross into Jordan. So you had really very little traffic. Tourists were not coming into Israel because the holy places, right? The Christians who are coming, they want to go to the old city, whether they need to come to Israel. The few exceptions are Christians who lived on the Israeli side who want to go to Bethlehem for Christmas. The Jordanians would allow them to come in. Samaritans, right? That's the picture that you have over here on the right, right? Samaritans, this ancient community, they see themselves as the true Jews. Jews see themselves as a sect. Their center is on Mount Gerizim by Shechem. Up until 48, they would make a pilgrimage there, but the community split into a group that stayed in Shechem and a group that moved to Cholon, right outside of Tel Aviv. And the Samaritans in Cholon still wanted to return to Mount Gerizim for the Passover sacrifice, and the Jordanians allowed them to go to cross over as well. And finally, the last group that could cross over were the Israeli military who were allowed to go up on Mount Scopus. According to the ceasefire agreements, every 2 weeks, a convoy of Israeli policemen were allowed to go up on Mount Scopus. That was according to the ceasefire agreements. Nobody respected this rule, right? The Israelis didn't. The Jordanians knew they didn't. It was an open secret, and they would actually say to them as they were coming to the Mandelbaum Gate, what kind of policeman are you? Are you Air Force policemen? Are you infantry policemen? Everybody knew they were soldiers, and they would smuggle in more and more ammunition and weapons until by 67, Mount Scopus was a very, very heavily fortified place. Now, the gate itself, who's Mandelbaum? Mandelbaum was a guy who wanted to build a house north of the old city. He wanted to increase Jewish settlement there. Didn't really work because his house remained isolated. The Arabs wouldn't sell land to other Jews. And so his house became isolated. And as things heated up by 48, he abandons the house. It's taken over by the Haganah. The Jordanians attack it. And eventually it becomes this crossing point. In June 67, the war is barely over. Teddy Kollek, the mayor of Jerusalem, decides to tear it down, right? And we're going to see that that's, in general, there's very little in the way of historical memory of these years, for better or for worse. We talked about Mount Scopus, right? Mount Scopus is this strange place, right? Very, very strategic, very, very important. Deep in Jordanian territory, it's going to be a stepping stone in the Six-Day War for getting to the old city. But it's a strange place between 48 and 67. The soldiers who are up there have to improvise. So, for example, they use the morgue in Hadassah Hospital as their refrigerator for fruits and vegetables. In general, it's a pretty quiet place, a tense place, but a quiet place. But in 1958, the Jordanians opened fire on a routine patrol. Four people died, two are wounded, including a UN officer. But Israel manages to hold on to Mount Scopus, which is going to be very important later in the story. Now, the other mountain that's an anomaly and that develops in a very different way is Mount Zion. Okay, Mount Zion is the only part of the old city. It's not within the walls, right? If you've been on Mount Zion, you know it's right outside the walls, but it's right next to the old city, and it remains in Israeli hands. And because it is the only part of the old city that remains in Israeli hands, it gains huge significance in these years between 48 and 67, because it's the only place you could go that you could feel that you are actually going to the holy places. So we have a lot of unusual things that develop here between 48 and 67, besides it being, you know, a military post and a place that from which we could then go into the old city in 67. So, for example, already during the War of Independence is a synagogue that's established on Mount Zion, the Sephardic Synagogue of Mount Zion. Today, a lot of the buildings that are there, by the way, have been taken over by the Diaspora Yeshiva since the 1970s. Things have changed. But before 67, we had various institutions like this, the Sephardic Synagogue. Another important thing, because the fighters in the Jewish quarter in 48 were not allowed to be taken out for burial after March of 48. They had to be buried inside the old city, inside the Jewish quarter, something that was really anathema to the Jews, but that's what the Jordanians forbade them from taking the Jews out. So because of that, there are a few places around the city that were memorials to the fighters of the Jewish quarter because they couldn't visit their graves. One of them is on Mount Herzl, but one of them is here on Mount Zion. Right, and this is a memorial to the soldiers, not only soldiers, civilians who died in those final battles in the Jewish quarter. After the Six-Day War, the bodies were taken and buried in a communal grave on the Mount of Olives, but the memorials are still here. Now, Mount Zion is isolated, right? It's across the Hinnom Valley, right? Jewish Jerusalem is on the west side. Mount Zion is on the east side. Hinnom Valley, no man's land in the middle. And there's a need to get supplies to evacuate people and to have a measure of secrecy in doing that between the two Israeli points, right? On both sides of the Hinnom Valley. In 48, an Israeli engineer, a really extraordinary man named Uriel Chefetz, comes up with this crazy scheme to string a cable between both sides of the valley and to have a cable car, a tiny cable car, as you can see in the picture here. During the day, the cable was slackened down to the valley, but if they needed it at night, they would, you know, make it tighter and send the car back and forth. It was not practical. It was used for about 6 months and then they stopped using it, but it actually remained a secret until long after the Six-Day War. Today, there's a small museum right next door to the Mount Zion Hotel that talks about this. There was also a tunnel that was built. It was actually just reopened in honor of Jerusalem Day at the foot of Mount Zion, going up Mount Zion. So the access to there was a complicated story. But despite that, Jews made pilgrimages to Mount Zion because, like I said, it's the only place you could go. The place that becomes the pilgrimage site now is David's tomb. Whether or not it's King David, King David's descendants, a crusader, doesn't matter. Jews said, this is the holy place we can get to, and this is where we're going to go. When is the major time that they come? Okay, coming up this week, Isru Chag of Shavuot, the seventh day of the month of Sivan, which is, according to tradition, King David's birthday and death day. And people would come despite the danger, despite the snipers. They would come on pilgrimage to King David's tomb. Another important personality who would come to Mount Zion was the second president of Israel, Yitzhak Ben Zvi, deeply, deeply connected to all different parts of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And he wanted to have a place where he could go and be close to the old city. So there was a room on top of King David's tomb called Cheder HaNasi, the president's room, and he would come there. Perhaps the most unusual and fascinating site on Mount Zion, which is still there today, by the way, is what's called the Chamber of the Holocaust, Martef HaShoah. If you ask most people, what's the first Holocaust museum in the world? Most people will say to you, Yad Vashem. But in fact, 4 years before Yad Vashem, we have this site. Now, this site has a fascinating story to it, and it is as unlike Yad Vashem as you could imagine. It's a very different sort of a site. It is not a museum. It's a memorial site. It's begun by a man named Shazach Shmuel Zanvil Kahana, whose father had been part of the rabbinical court in Warsaw, the head of the rabbinical court in Warsaw. They managed to get out in 1940. They come, they live in the old city. Of course, they have to leave in 48. But he, Shmuel Kahana, the son, becomes the minister for religious affairs. And he decides that there has to be a memorial place for survivors to come and to remember their communities. What better place to do this than on Mount Zion, right? Why Mount Zion? Closeness to the holy places, the grave of King David, right? King David connected to redemption, connected to Mashiach, right? Plus, we have a verse in the book of Ovadia, Ubahar Tzion Tihyeh Pleita, and on Mount Zion, there's going to be a refuge, the survivors. So what does he do? He takes over an abandoned building, a building that had belonged to the Muslim family that controlled Mount Zion before 48, the Dajani family, which is all underground. That's why it's called the Martef, the basement. And he basically does a grassroots effort. He goes to whoever he knows from the Landsmannschaften, the community organizations of survivors. And he says, if you want to remember your community, make a plaque. There's no standard design. Do whatever you want. Bring it to me and I will put it up on the walls. And it's whoever decided to come. So you have communities, enormous communities, like you can see Lublin here, or there's Vilna. You have teeny tiny communities that nobody's ever heard of, like Tranigrad. You even have groups of people who are not communities, but rather they escaped together, they were prisoners of war together, whatever. They accepted everything. Anybody who wanted to memorialize something, you put it in there and they just put them up as they came up, and other things that survivors wanted to give. And this was really, it's not a museum, right? Yad Vashem is very, very focused on historical accuracy and telling the story. This was a way for the survivors to tell their story, to have a place to remember what happened. And that's why sometimes people, Yad Vashem in particular, say, well, things there, they're not historically accurate. They're not telling the truth. This is what the survivors believe and want remembered. And it's very much a part of this 1950s Israel that we talked about last time, right? This memorial to the survivors and to their experience. Meanwhile, we have to build new things, right? We're a new state, we have new institutions, and we have a commitment that was made to Theodor Herzl, right? Theodor Herzl dies in 1904 in Vienna, and he writes in his will when the state of Israel is created, not if, when, he wants his bones to be taken out of the grave in Vienna and reinterred in the state of Israel. And indeed, one of the first official acts that Israel does after the war is over is to bring Herzl's bones from Vienna to Jerusalem. Where are they going to put him? We said the only direction you can go is west. So they pick a hilltop on the western edge of the city, very empty hilltop. Today it is not so empty, and they create what we call today Mount Herzl, right? And Mount Herzl was meant to have two different functions. One was that along with Herzl, you would have a pantheon, all the great leaders, prime ministers, the presidents, the speakers of the Knesset, Jews being Jews, not all the great leaders decided that they wanted to be buried on Mount Herzl. So Begin is on the Mount of Olives and Ben-Gurion is in the Negev. Okay, fine, but there's still enough important people there. The other part of the hill is the cemetery of very important, but not as famous people, a military cemetery, right? There's a need, unfortunately, for a large military cemetery, terrible casualties of the 1948 war. This is, of course, not the only military cemetery in Israel, but it's the one where the main ceremonies are held and there are memorials there. And that's what Mount Herzl is. And of course, right next door to it is where Yad Vashem is built, right? This not very subtle connection between Zionism and the Holocaust. If Zionism had been around, the Holocaust might not have happened. It would have happened differently, right? The two are very much connected. But we still needed a place for all of the new institutions, right? We need a new center, not to replace the old city. The hope is, of course, that we'll go back to the old city. But the old city is also not a place where you're going to put government institutions, cultural institutions, educational institutions. And the decision is, again, has to be in the West. Make it far away from the old city. Make it far away from the Jordanians, from any conflict that might happen. So what do? They choose a small hill in the west of the city. It had been an Arab village called Sheikh Bader, right? The Arabs fled in 1948. Part of it was used as a temporary cemetery, right, until Haram Nuchot was created. But mostly it was used for these new buildings, right? And by the way, some of the houses of Sheikh Bader were still around till not even 10 years ago. Today there's a whole high-rise building there, but a lot of the houses had been there up until very recently. One of the first buildings that's built, takes a very long time to build, is this one, the International Convention Center, Binyanei Ha'uma, right? Built for Zionist congresses, right? But you also needed to have a place for, like we said, education. Hebrew University, not far away, Gibat Ram, right? Cultural institutions, the new Israel Museum, right? 1960s, 1965, you want to have that. And of course, a government center, the Knesset, right? The Knesset starts out in Tel Aviv because Jerusalem is still under fire, goes through a bunch of locations. When things calm down in Jerusalem, moves to Jerusalem, but it's basically in an office building on King George Street, right? This is the Fruman building. You can still see it today. It's supposed to one day become a museum of the Knesset. Mashiach will come first, but you know, that's the plan. And this is where it is. But everybody understands that this cannot be where the main government building of the country is. You have to have a real building, but the problem is that Israel in the 50s has very little money. So there's a plan to create a building, but it's only when the Rothschild Foundation comes and kind of ponies up the money that they are able to hold an architectural competition and to build the new Knesset building, which is the Knesset building of today in 1966. Of course, again, Jews being Jews, this is the building that is built with the inspiration being the Parthenon and democracy and the ideals of Greek democracy. And of course, there are Jews who say, what, Greeks? Hellenism? We're Jews. We don't want this. It doesn't matter. This is what they build. This is what it is today. Today, of course, the Knesset and the area around it has many, many more governmental institutions. The Supreme Court building, which is truly an amazing building and is not Hellenistic in any way, and many other governmental buildings. And Givat Ram really becomes this center in Jerusalem. But now we're going to get to our story of the Six-Day War. And obviously, this is a very long story, but in the 10 years between the Sinai campaign, right, in 1956 and the spring of 67, more and more tensions between Israel and the Arab world. Syrian attacks, as we're going to see on the Golan, attempts to divert the water, the Jordan River water. Egyptians coming in and being more aggressive in the Sinai, in the Straits of Tiran. Gamal Abdel Nasser becoming president, and his aggression for his own reasons. And all of this begins to come to a head in May of 67. Right? May of 67, on the 16th, Nasser goes into the Sinai and essentially says to the UN forces that have been there since 56, hey, you need to get out now. And they pack up their bags and leave without saying a word. Okay? And a few days later, May 22nd, they close the International Straits of Tehran. Both of these are clearly something that could be seen as acts of war. Okay? Meanwhile, more and more aggressive portrayals in the Arab press, and that's what you're seeing here, right? Here's Nasser kicking the very stereotypical Jew into the sea, right? And many, many other portrayals like that. And the question is what to do, right? And Israel is unsure what to do because, yes, these are aggressive provocations and acts of war, but are we ready for war? Remember, we are a 19-year-old state. We are a teenage state. We're very young. We've just kind of built up our army to a certain point. We've just built up our economy. We're finally a little bit prosperous. Are we ready for a war like this? And there is really a very deep-seated fear, and not only a panic and paranoia, but a real fear that, God forbid, this might be another Holocaust. And there are many differences of opinion of how to react, of when to react. Abba Ibn, who is the gentleman over here on the left, the foreign minister, right, very one of the many people in Israel who was very respected abroad and less respected at home, very, very, very articulate. And he is sent around to France, to England, to the United States. What should we do? Arab aggression. And the basic answer that he gets from everybody is, you know, you're right. Sit tight. Don't do anything. Sit tight. Don't do anything. Right. And the fear is, what's going to be if we sit tight and don't do anything? Are we going to be swallowed up? And we have this very tense, what's called the waiting period, Kufata Hamtana, of about 2.5 weeks, where the government is trying to decide what to do. Meanwhile, what's happening on the civilian front, okay, and this is what you're seeing in the picture here, trenches are dug, sandbags are filled, cemeteries are laid out. There's a very chilling description if you've ever read Yehuda Avner's wonderful book, The Prime Ministers, where he writes about going to Tel Aviv and watching rabbis walking around a public park and basically cordoning it off for a new cemetery. Nobody knows what's going to happen. There's a lot of fear. Meanwhile, Jews from the diaspora, North America, sending money, some of them flying in to volunteer. But all of this comes to a head on the morning of June 5th, 1967, decision is made to strike. This is something that the Air Force has been preparing for a long time, right? It's what's called a Tochnit Megera, a plan that's in the drawer, right? But they take it out of the drawer, and the plan is to strike the Egyptian Air Force while it is still on the ground. Okay, Israel has been watching the Egyptian Air Force for months and months and months, and they see that they are in a complete routine, right? They get up, whatever, 6 a.m. They go, they fly their morning exercises, they land the planes at 7:30, everybody goes to eat breakfast, right? And then they come back to work. And Israel knows this. And so what they do is they take almost the entire Air Force, right? It's a crazy, if it had failed, it would have meant the end of our Air Force. They take almost the entire Air Force, fly under the radar, which of course means that if your plane is in trouble, you can't get any help, eh? And they fly down to Egypt and they bomb the Air Force while it is sitting on the runway, right? It's an incredible, unbelievable, audacious, preemptive strike, but it's not really a preemptive strike because we've had these acts of war earlier, right? And you have this internal memo in the Air Force, right, from the commander of the Air Force, Moti Hod, and what does he write? Lochamei Chel Ha'avir, fighters of the Air Force, Ha'oyev Ha'mitzri Ha'mishtachsef Ba'mitgarer, right, the arrogant and provocative Egyptian enemy, Henif Yado Aleinu L'chaloteinu, is holding up its arm, its hand in order to destroy us. L'chel Ha'avir Egrofo Ha'kamut Shel Tzahal Nitan Hatzav, okay, to the Air Force, the rolled up fist, right? The fighting fist of the army is given the order, Hemreinu Lakrav, we have taken off into battle. Hechela Achulia Shlishi B'Milchamteinu La'atzmaut, this is the third piece in our battle for independence. And he goes on, Rucham Shel Giborei Yisrael B'chol HaTorot Tilaveh Otanu Bakrav, the spirit of the fighters of Israel, the warriors of Israel throughout the generations will be with us, right? Yoshua and David and Maccabim, right? He throws in everything. Tusu Utu Al Ha'oyeh, fly, attack the enemy. Hakubo ad chorma, hit him until he is destroyed. Hashmidu mitzlaotav, destroy all of his canals. I think I'm translating that correctly. Hafitzu b'midbar l'chol ever, spread him out in the desert to all directions. L'man yishkon am Yisrael abetach b'artzo l'dor v'dor, so that Israel will be able to be secure in its land forever, right? Super powerful message. And this is an incredible success. However, it has to be kept as a silent success, right? This is not reported in Israel until the next day, right? And there's a lot of ambivalence in the press, in the foreign press, and in the Israeli press. Did we destroy the Israeli Air Force, the Egyptian Air Force? Did the Egyptian Air Force destroy our Air Force? Nasser takes advantage of that ambivalence. He knows what happens, but Hussein, the king of Jordan, does not know what happens. And we know, we have intelligence that Nasser calls up Hussein on that first morning of the war. He knows he has no more Air Force, and he bluffs. And he says to Hussein, Israel's Air Force has been destroyed. You better get in on the action now, or you will lose everything, because we will take everything. We, Egypt, the Syrians, we will take everything, and you, little Jordan, will be left with nothing. Now, Israel had already sent messages to Hussein saying, don't involve us in a war. We don't want to fight you. You shouldn't fight us. Do not open up another front. And Hussein, who is a very, very savvy man, makes the one most terrible decision of his career. And he listens to Nasser, and he attacks in Jerusalem. Now realize, attacking in Jerusalem is not like attacking in the Sinai. The border is the width of a street. So it's very, very frightening. In the beginning, the battles begin in the south. Like I said before, start out in UN headquarters, spread to the Jewish side of Jerusalem, to the neighborhoods of Abu Tor, near Ramat Rachel over here. This is the Bell outpost, Mutzava Pa'amon. And by the night between the first and the second days of the war, the battle spreads to the north of the city. Okay, the north of the city is a very significant place to take hold of, because we want to be able to leapfrog from Israeli positions up to Mount Scopus, and then into the old city. The decision has not yet been made to take the old city, right? Moshe Dayan, the defense minister, is not pro taking the old city, but they still have to defend the city. They take a Jordanian stronghold called Ammunition Hill, Givat HaTachmoshet, just on the other side of the border with Israel. As its name implies, right, a place of great stores of ammunition, trenches, bunkers, fierce and terrible fighting. 36 Israeli soldiers fall on Ammunition Hill, twice that number Jordanian soldiers fall on Ammunition Hill. But by the morning of the second day of the war, Israel has taken Ammunition Hill and is moving in the direction, right, north and east towards Mount Scopus. They go towards the Damascus Gate. They make a wrong turn at a certain point, and 8 soldiers are killed. And I realize they've never been to these places before. These guys are 19, 20, 21 years old. And this is a memorial here in the middle. Finally, they make it to the Rockefeller Museum. Fierce battles here. You can still see the pockmarks on the wall today. And continue on towards Mount Scopus. And the decision is made on the third day of the war to take the old city, right? And of course, we have these very famous pictures of the paratroopers who were supposed to be in the Sinai Bichlal. They were not supposed to be in Jerusalem, but because of the preemptive strike, they're freed up and they're sent to Jerusalem, coming in through the Lion's Gate, going up on the Temple Mount, right? And this is after the battles are over. Moshe Dayan, Yitzhak Rabin, who's the Ramatkal, who's the chief of staff, Uzi Narkis, who's the head of the forces in Jerusalem, going up to the Temple Mount. But one of the paradoxes of the story is that Jews did not have access to the Temple Mount for centuries because it was such a Muslim stronghold. The only place they were familiar with was the Kotel, was the Western Wall. And you can hear in the very famous recording, right? There's a young reporter named Yossi Ronen, who's actually running with his microphone and a guy behind him, you know, connected by a wire to the tape deck and reporting as he goes. It's an amazing piece of reporting. And he hears people saying when they're on the Temple Mount, Efo Akotel, where is the Kotel? We want to go down to the Kotel because that's really what they associate with the holy places. And that's, of course, where we have this iconic picture taken by David Rubinger of the 3 paratroopers at the Kotel. Rav Goren, who comes along when he hears that the paratroopers are breaking through Lion's Gate, carrying a Sefer Torah, carrying a shofar, blowing the shofar, saying the Shecheyanu and saying the Kaddish prayers for the dead, at the Kotel, right? Very, very powerful moment. A few weeks later, we have this fabulous picture of the wedding of one of the paratroopers at the Kotel, right? At the Western Wall. But this return, of course, is a complicated one, but a very important one. And of course, it happens exactly a week before Shavuot. Jerusalem Day is a week before Shavuot. And Israel prepares for the massive influx of visitors. They bulldoze the houses that have been built up to the Kotel, and they prepare for this huge number of visitors that show up on Shavuot night. Now, meanwhile, okay, we've taken out the Egyptian Air Force. We've managed to take the Sinai. We take Jerusalem and the West Bank, but you still have the Golan, right? You still have the Golan. And the question is, what's going to be with the Golan? The Golan is a very dangerous, very strategic place. The Syrians control the Golan, meaning they control the water, right? And we know that in the 60s, they attempt to divert some of the headwaters of the Jordan to Syrian area. Not only that, but they are high up, right, looking down on the Chula Valley and on the Israeli farmers who are down in the Chula Valley, and they can just attack at will, and snipers, and really making life hell. This is a picture from a place called Mitzpeh Gadot, right? It was a Syrian outpost before 67, where you have this incredible view down into the Chula Valley. And when the commander of the north comes to visit it after the war is over, he says something that becomes a very iconic saying. He says, and this is what's on the stone here, Mikan atem nir'im gdolim shivatayim. From here you look 70 times as big, meaning the farmers, right? And how they were able to withstand the Syrian aggression from on top. But meanwhile, Israel has enough with the fronts in Egypt, the front in Jordan. What's going to be? The Syrians have not entered the war, and Israel is not quite sure that they can deal with another front. But by the fourth day of the war, as the Arabs are in retreat, there's a group of residents from the Golan who come and petition the prime minister to enlarge the battle, to spread it to the Golan Heights so that it can be taken back and so that they can live in security. Now, just to take a step backwards, right, up until 1965, in the early 60s, we had this incredible spy in Damascus, Eli Cohen, There's been a couple of movies about him recently. Eli Cohen is a Sephardi Jew, and he volunteers for the incredibly dangerous position of becoming a spy, an insider in the Syrian world. He goes to Argentina. He creates a new identity as an Arab businessman. He comes back to Damascus. He is super successful at integrating not only with the VIPs of the government and of the business world in Syria, but of the army. Okay? And he becomes so successful and so much of a chum with all these guys that they actually take him into closed military zones like the Golan. And of course, all of these expeditions and all of these friendships are very, very useful because he's, of course, providing all this information back to Israel. Tragically, he is caught in 1965. He is hung in the streets of Damascus. We still have not gotten his body back. But you can follow his story in the Golan. Today, there's a trail called the Eli Cohen Trail. And this is this picture on the right here is one of the stations along it, where you can see where he went and what he did. Now, the information that he provides to Israel is invaluable when we come to the battles on the fifth and the sixth day of the war. Fifth day, very difficult, but by the end of the fifth day, it's a fight against the clock. We know that the Western powers are going to impose a ceasefire on us. And so everybody is enlisted, including cooks, by the way, in the army, to go sit on hilltops. Whatever we've taken, just find somebody to put on a hilltop there so that when the ceasefire is put into place, we will be able to say we control these areas. And by the end of the sixth day of the war, the Golan is in Israeli hands. What happens in Yom Kippur War is a separate story, also an important story, but let's just kind of back up for a minute. What did we gain, right? What did we gain and what is the trajectory of the war? So the dates you can see on the right in case you were confused. We went through that pretty quickly, but just take a look at the change in from little Israel to Israel as a power, right? As a mighty power, which by the way, we try to use this power to bargain and to gain peace. And we are completely, completely rejected by the Arab world. But already 3 weeks after the war, Levi Eshkol, the prime minister, goes to the Arab world and says, we will give you back some of these territories in return for peace. And the answer is a complete no, no to recognition of Israel, no to peace, right? No to everything. But take a look at what we gained, okay? The Sinai, right? This enormous area of the Sinai, the Gaza Strip, Yudan, Shomron, important in terms of the width of Israel, but even more important in terms of the historical sites, the biblical sites, the connection to Hebron, Shiloh, Har Gerizim, Har Eval, right? All of these incredibly important places, and the Golan Heights with a strategic advantage of height, of water. So this is just a huge turnaround from the feeling a few weeks earlier that God forbid we're on the verge of another Holocaust to it just becoming maybe not an empire, but much more of an empire than we were before. We'll just finish with the song, right? What is the song? The Six-Day War happened to have a lot of good songs. Some wars get good songs, some wars don't get such good songs. The Six-Day War got a lot of good songs, but the iconic song of the Six-Day War is Jerusalem of Gold. But the irony is that Jerusalem of Gold, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, is actually not written in the Six-Day War. It's written before the Six-Day War. And the story is like this, right? Naomi Shemer, who is the songwriter of the era, right? She's an incredibly prolific and amazing songwriter. She writes this song. Why? Because Teddy Kollek, the new mayor of Jerusalem in March of 67, morale is very low. And he says, let's create a song contest about Jerusalem, and maybe that will raise morale. And she enters the contest. Of course she wins because it's the best song, right? And it's got all of these biblical references, Talmudic references, right? And we all know Yerushalayim shel Zahav, v'shel Nechoshet, v'shel Or, Jerusalem of gold and bronze and light. Halo lechoshi raich ani kinor. I am a song for all, I am a violin for all your songs. But perhaps the most important part of the song is this, the first paragraph, Ha'ir Asher Badad Yoshevet, the city that sits alone, right? Just referencing Echa, Ubili Bachomain, in its midst, in its heart is a wall. Now that wall could be the Western Wall. That wall could be the wall that divides the city in half, right? Either way, the song is reflecting the reality of a divided Jerusalem and of a yearning to return to Jerusalem. Now the song becomes a huge hit. It's on the radio. It's everywhere. Okay. Fast forward. It's the third day of the war, June 7th, 1967. Naomi Shemer is down in the South. She is entertaining the troops. And what comes on the radio? The Temple Mount is in our hands. She hears the paratroopers at the Kotel. They are singing this song. Okay, this is such a hit that they are singing this song. And she sits down and she writes the last paragraph of the song, right? Chazarnu el borot hamayim, we have returned to the cisterns, to the shuk, to the marketplace, to the kikar, shofar korei bahar havayit, a shofar is heard on the Temple Mount, right? Rav Goren, ba'ir ha'atika, right? We have come back. So this is a song from before the war, it's a song from after the war, and it definitely is the iconic song of the Six-Day War. So let's take a look. I see we have lots of comments, lots of questions. Let's see what we got here. I'll go back to the beginning. And with the partition plan, Jews would have been able to live in Jerusalem. That is technically true, but not really. Because if you look at the partition plan, you see that Jerusalem is deep within Arab territory. How could Jews have lived safely there? Unclear, right? Jordan occupied that land illegally. UN had allocated it to a new Arab state. Yes, this is very true. The reality post 48 is definitely different than what the UN had imagined. How many Jews live in Abu Tor? I don't know numbers, but historically, it's not. It's the upper part of the neighborhood is actually has been a Jewish neighborhood from before 67. And you can walk down the street and you can see the Arab houses on one side, the Jewish houses on the other side. El Paso was on the roof of Notre Dame, right? And I've heard that from a lot of people wondering if I would ever get into the old city. Other people, right? It really is amazing to hear those stories. Wow. And you went in person to see everything on Shavuot. So cool. I love hearing people's stories. I went to Givat Ram and seeing the Arab farmers plowing the fields, right? That makes sense. Okay, we ran all over the city to study in the 70s. Exactly, because there was, they still hadn't moved everything. Ben Gurion wanted the hospital in Ein Karim, so the city would expand that direction. It definitely makes sense. I have not read anything like that, but it certainly is very logical. Uri Tzvi Greenberg loved Mount Zion. The diaspora yeshiva is just before 1970, right? Is it really King David's tomb? We'll have to do another, old city Tanakh tour, but probably not. Probably the dynasty of King David, but there are differences of opinion. People needed to go through a passageway that was not very safe, but they were able to go there. The Holocaust Memorial, the Chamber of the Holocaust is on Mount Zion, right? Not far from the train station, but not right there. Kiryat HaMemshala, thank you. Yes. No, the Hamtana was not just Eshkol's indecision and anxiety. Eshkol is a very, very underrated leader. I would definitely place him in the top three of Israel's prime ministers. He was an amazing, amazing person who accomplished a lot. He wasn't a speaker. He wasn't, somebody who was charismatic like Ben-Gurion, like Begin, but he was a very, very accomplished and very down-to-earth person. And the Hamtana was very real. It was very real. Nobody knew what was going to be. Nobody knew what we should do and how it would all play out. Diane was not excited about taking the old city. This is true. But on the other hand, it's difficult to know what's the right choice, right? The Kotel wedding picture couple were in Nachal Moriah and their firstborn, first baby in the old city. Oh, so nice. Batya, you always have nice things to add. Okay, yes, Rav Goren and Hebron is a fascinating story. Also, basically, Judea and Samaria pretty much fell without battles, okay, because Jerusalem had fallen. And Rav Goren wanted to get to Hebron first. And the famous story is that he gets to Ma'arat HaMachpelah before the army gets there. Okay, yes, the Eli Cohen soldier story with the trees. Tragically, it is a great story that is almost definitely not true. But it is a good story. But the fact is that Eli Cohen was in Damascus in the 60s up until 65. Full-grown trees do not grow in 2 years. So it's not so good. But there are a lot of other amazing, amazing things that Eli Cohen did. You're welcome. Thank you. I went to Israel right after the Six-Day War to study for 6 months. Soldiers everywhere. Yes, amazing. Name of the Holocaust Memorial I will write. And thank you. And guys, I'm very happy to hear suggestions, what people want to learn next. Rabbi Kalman has generously offered to do another series. So anyone who has thoughts, if I can do it, I will be happy to.
Thank you
Okay,
very
the
much.
name of the museum is Chamber of the Holocaust or Martef HaShoah.
Julie, thank you very much for another wonderful series. And I think all the comments you see and, you know, miksat shvachol lefanav. But I want to thank you very much and the crowd. And like you said at the beginning, of course, we all echo your thoughts that, you know, what we can do, where there's, especially those of us who don't live in Israel, there's very little that we can do. We can daven and help and write letters, etc. But let's just hope that we have quiet in Israel, and then quiet turning into real peace, please God. But I want to thank you again. You should be well. Shabbat Shalom, I hope. Chag Sameach. And we look forward to learning with you in the future. And your kids should all be well. And I hope your daughter can get home for Yontif. But I understand. Okay. All the best. Thank you very much.